I want to start off today with a little activity to get you engaged. You might have been outside, or if not, been a bit sleepy. So I'm going to pass around some sheets of paper, and I want you to just take a piece, and I'll get one going on this side. We've got some pens here, and the first three words that come to your mind when I ask you, who's God? Specifically, if you have some background, who's God of the Old Testament? Just write those things, three words, whatever they are. I am. Charlton Heston-esque. Mysterious, cloud, creator, judge, Yahweh, all powerful. Trust, King, grace, forgiveness, love, omnipresent, protector, veracity, faithful, life, trust. This guy, Daniel Kahneman, is a Nobel Prize-winning behavioral economist, which means his job is to figure out how people figure things out, why they do what they do, how they act, why we act. And one of his observations is that we're pretty rarely stumped in our mental lives. We have this system of thinking that allows us, when put in a context, to start generating ideas very quickly. Someone asks you your opinion on Iraq. You may not have it right away, but you'll figure it out. And that's basically because we have very good mental maps. That's the way our mind works. We don't like to have things not related to each other. Andy actually had talked about this a long time ago at ASAP, how we have these maps, and some are small. Some are bigger, but they're basically maps that have, just like a regular map, are at, and how, even more so maybe, how they relate to one another. And so today I want to take us through and see what our maps are about the Old Testament. And so that's why I wanted to get you thinking about who God is, specifically out of the Old Testament. And in general, if you don't have experience with what the Old Testament is, just to understand what the Old Testament might give us as a map about God. The Old Testament is full of lots of different stories. Here's a few parts: the creation story, the Exodus, the Israel coming out of Egypt, the law is given, judges come to help Israel, kings come along. Israelites go into exile, prophets are mixed in there, and all of these things connect with each other. Or maybe they don't for you. They're all different. And so my question is there a central message that goes through this? And if so, what is it? So I'm going to ask you again to think. This may stump you a little bit more than the last one, but write down, we have a few sheets of paper here, just write down on the other side, just to hand them back out again, what you think the central message of the Old Testament is. Try one sentence or less. No, that's good. That's good. Thank you for doing that. God is in his creation setting. There is only one true God. God reveals himself to man. God is making a people for himself. God is in control of all things. Obey God. A continuing story of redemption. salvation all leads to Jesus, the Savior, who's coming. People who need a Redeemer, He reigns. Rescue, redemption, calling. It's good. I had you think about this because I think it's good to sometimes sit back and reflect on the maps that we are using to put things together. These maps, like the guy who I quoted was saying, we often just have them underlying everything and we don't often reflect on them. When we move out of our normal spot, though, it can be a good time to reflect on what's valuable. I'm sure for Rie and Toshi, coming from Japan to Canada, the map that they used to get by in Japan doesn't always fit in Canada. I remember the first time I went to a really different culture. I went to the Congo, and I recall a big feast being put out in front of us. And at this feast, there was lots of foods that I didn't recognize, but there were two foods I did recognize, bananas and peanuts. And so, of course, what do? I maybe try a little bit of the other things, but I take a couple bananas and a whole bunch of peanuts on my plate. Apparently, that wasn't the thing to do. Those were dessert. And so someone came up along beside me and just helped me put them back. Of course, it felt very awkward. But my map for how food works, how feasts work, didn't quite work. And it took some reflection back, being out of my element, to see what was happening there. And so today I want to help you see maybe a different perspective about the Old Testament. What connects the stories together? What are the various parts of it? And feel free to criticize. Feel free to think differently. Feel free to study on your own as well, too. The map I'm going to share with you, I got from one of my professors in school. And I find it really helpful to understand what the Old Testament is talking about. How about you? You wrote down your maps of the Old Testament. How do you feel about them? Complete? Or have some gaps in there? What do you think? What's your comfort with understanding the Old Testament? Feel free just to answer. Lots of gaps? How so? You feel like there's more out there that you don't quite grasp.
Yeah.
Aaron, you said?
Oh, I just think a lot that happened in the Old Testament is hard to reconcile morally.
Mm. For sure.
Yeah.
We were talking about this just a few weeks ago with our church. One of the passages in the lectionary that we were reading was about the fear of the Lord. And so we were talking about what does that mean to fear God? We don't like to be in fear of people. And so exactly that. How do we reconcile some of these stories that don't seem to fit? Well, I want to go through and take a look at a passage which I think is really helpful. It's Exodus 5, 22 through 6, 8. If you've got Bibles, you can open it up to that. I have the text up here so you can follow along, but if you have it around, you can flip it open because we'll be moving around a little bit with it as well, too. Give you a second to load that up. I'll set a bit of the context that comes here as you're going there. So Exodus is the book where the Israelites move out of Egypt, and it's all about the process of that, at least the first part of Exodus. And so in this particular passage, we've got Moses and Aaron. They're the leaders of the Hebrew people, and they've just met with Pharaoh, who is the king of Egypt, and they've met with him for the first time. Really to demand freedom, But in this case, they've actually just asked for essentially for 3 days off. They want to give their people a long weekend to go out into the desert and, in their words, offer sacrifices to God. So does anyone recall what Pharaoh's response to this ask is?
No.
Yeah, not so happy. In fact, he kind of flies off the handle. He calls them a bunch of lazy, good-for-nothings, tells them since they had the gall to ask for 3 days off, they're clearly not being worked hard enough. And so in addition to the bricks they're making, they can actually go get all the straw now for the bricks. But don't they dare think about making less bricks. They got to keep their quota together for the bricks. Nope. Yeah, yeah. And so that's the context of the story. They've asked for the time off. Pharaoh comes back and says, "No way." The Hebrews, what do you think their response is? Do you recall? Yeah. Pretty much, although not as much actually at God as much at Moses. They're angry with Moses for making what they seem as their life worse. Exactly, miserable. And then that leads us to Moses' reaction, which we get here. And feel free to follow along here. Oh, one other thing. I put up here, whenever you see sometime in your Bibles, you'll notice the words Lord in all capitals. I've replaced it with Yahweh because that's what the Hebrew has underneath. And Lord seems more like a title, but Yahweh is more a name, less a title and more a name. And so I want you to think about that. I'll explain a little bit more why I did that in a bit too, but we'll read through this. So Moses returned to Yahweh and said, "Why, Lord, have you brought trouble on this people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has brought trouble on this people, and you have not rescued your people at all." Then Yahweh said to Moses, "Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of his country." God also said to Moses, "I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name Yahweh, I did not make myself fully known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, where they resided as foreigners. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am Yahweh." To understand that section a little better, I want to go through and just take a look at how it's structured. Moses starts off with basically two parts. He has two questions, which he starts with. Why have you brought trouble? Why have you sent me? And then he registers his complaint. "Ever since I went to Pharaoh, you have done nothing." and answers the complaint, basically saying, just watch me. I'm going to take care of this. Very straightforward, no problem. Jumps right into it. He doesn't actually get that upset about Moses for being all emotional with God about what God hasn't done, despite Moses' rebuke to God. But then, the next section, so this is pretty straightforward, just answering that complaint. Just watch me. I'm going to take care of business for you. It's the next section that really jumps into the response to the question, God, what are you up to? And I think this part is where we get a really good sense of what God's plan is. There's four things that come out of this plan. But before I jump into that, there's a phrase here that appears a bunch of times. What is it? I am Yahweh. Yeah. It jumps four times, you see. I am Yahweh. So I want to talk about that word Yahweh a little bit. What do you know about Yahweh? What does that mean? Who's Yahweh? Good answer, but no. The Hebrew word can be translated, and if you look back just a few chapters in Exodus 3, Moses at the burning bush hears God's name. God calls himself Yahweh. I am who I am. That's the verb there. Or you can also translate that, I cause to be what I cause to be. Any other ideas? Has anyone ever talked to you about who Yahweh is? Not so much? Not really?
Was there something unspeakable about it?
Like
they didn't say his name or something?
Good point. Well, it's certainly an element of mysteriousness to it. Like, even just to say, I am who I am, that's not very defining. Call me I am who I am. In the ancient Near East, the time when this was happening, there was some sense that people had a secret name. And that's because to know someone's name was to have some degree of control over them. If you know someone's name, you can call them. I can call Andy, and he has to respond to me. And so that could be part of it. Yahweh is a bit enigmatic. It's a mysterious. We don't quite know who this person is, and we can't for sure control this person. That's part of it. Some other people have suggested it's just about existence. God is telling us that he exists. The only issue with that is that's probably more of a mental map from us Westerners through our education tradition. We like to think about things in philosophical qualities like all-powerful or all-knowing, that kind of thing. The Hebrews thought of God more in terms of action. God does. God creates. God redeems. And so along with those lines then, I think it's maybe helpful to look into this section to see exactly how Yahweh is defined here, and as well how in that little section a little bit earlier in Exodus 3 where Moses is at the burning bush, how Yahweh is defined there. And really, there's two parts that I see. One of them is presence. I'm Yahweh. I'm here. I'm telling you I'm here. Earlier in chapter 3, Yahweh says, I will be with you. There's the idea that Yahweh is here and present. But not just as a kind of a third wheel, a person who's following along, but in a very specific action way. What's the main action that Yahweh says he's going to do here?
Deliver.
Deliver, yeah. Yahweh's going to deliver. And he says the same thing back at the burning bush. He says, I declare that I will bring you up out of the misery of Egypt. Same word, bring you up is the word, the Hebrew word for deliver. And so I think as you think of Yahweh, one of the great ways or really useful ways you can think of who that is present to act in deliverance. That's who Yahweh is, present to act in salvation. So then, let's jump into the four parts that Yahweh describes. Well, we've kind of talked about the first part here. There's a couple of key words that jump out here. Bring you out, the deliverer, free, redeem. That's the first part of Yahweh's plan for his people. I'm going to deliver you. I'm going to bring you up out of Egypt. I'm going to rescue you. But where is he delivering them into? Well, the second part jumps into that. Is he delivering them as individuals out into the desert? Is he delivering them as just families or even as tribes? He's delivering them as his own people. He's creating a new community. So he's not just deliverance for the sake of rescue, but he's calling people into his own community. The third part then is what his people can expect as that deliverance happens. It's that people will know that Yahweh is their God. Now, we sometimes think of know. Like, what do you think of when you think of knowledge? What comes to your mind? Books? Yeah. Tests. Hebrews had a bit of a different word to know. It was very experiential and almost embarrassingly so. If you think back right to the beginning, what was the word that described Adam and Eve? They knew each other. It's like, whew, I'm blushing up here. In a similar sense, though, God is saying his people would be intimate with him, not just knowing a few checkboxes about him, but that people were going to have an experiential knowledge of who God is. So that's the third part. Deliverance for community and a knowledge of God, experiential knowledge. And then this fourth part, where are they going to experience all of this? It's the land. What does the land represent? What did the land of Canaan represent to the Israelites? Pardon? Promised, fulfillment of a promise. How was that land described?
Prosperous.
What? Pardon?
Fertile.
Yeah. What was the phrase that Joshua used to describe it? Flowing with milk and honey. The land represented this place of blessing that that the Hebrews would experience as they went into this. Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden we're saying, can you imagine today if there was a refugee community and the government came along, some authority came along and said, we're going to give you a space that's going to be yours.
Mm-hmm.
There would be a sense of security.
Yeah.
Along with that, okay, we have a place where we'll be safe.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's really good. So that's really this fourfold plan. And I think it seems maybe a bit simplistic, but I think it actually gives us a really good framework for what the Old Testament is all about. Now you may be wondering,